House and Senate conferees are trying to reach agreement on key measures before a bill decking deadline tonight. They're trying to line up the bills for a floor vote before the legislative session wraps up next week, Thursday. The controversial Airbnb bill appears to be dying. It was put off indefinitely, with conferees saying yesterday they were still far apart. We check in with political reporter Wayne Yoshioka on the progress of the session so far.
Well, we had 220 bills that went to conference committee. A lot of them have gone through. All in all, we had more than 2,500 bills that were introduced back in January. Some of the bills, like the Death with Dignity bill, passed, like, it was signed into law April 5th, which was 12 days before it had to be, you know, go up to the governor. That one happened because the Senate had already approved it last session, and so all the House had to do was get it passed their House and then, you know, send it up to the Senate. So that one went fast. Another one was the constitutional amendment authorizing the, or asking the voters, whether they want to allow the legislature to levy some kind of an investment property surcharge to help fund public education. That one went through relatively easy. And I think people need to understand that that bill had nothing to do with public education. It had nothing to do with teacher raises or teacher shortages, but that is all about having the legislature levy property taxes, which is a big issue. And if you figure that the home ownership rate in Hawaii is something like 48%, you've got 48% of the people in Hawaii saying, wait a minute, do we really want to go down that slippery slope and have the legislature levy a property tax on me, plus having the counties do the same thing? So those things were, you know, need to be considered as we go forward.
Right, and I know the counties are nervous because real property tax is really their kuleana, and they don't really like the state kind of picking their pocket.
Right. It's a big home rule issue, too, you know. They were given the power to levy property taxes, and that's their only source of income. If they start adding a surcharge on the higher-end properties, that means that they're probably those property values are going to go down, and that means that they'll have less property taxes from those that, you know, $2 million properties around the state.
Right. And at the same time, though, we didn't hear a lot of squawking on the Honolulu County side, I guess because we are tapping into the GE, the general excise tax, to pay for rail. And there are issues with the hotel room tax as well. So it's not really clean, yet it'll make people uncomfortable to think that now the state can then use property taxes as a way to raise money.
I mean, both the state and the counties are really looking to raise revenue. I mean, they've got increasing revenues. You've got the police department that needs to hire more police officers. They need like 2,100 total officers, and they're like 65% filled. And so they have some real big issues at the county level. Their highways, their bridges are all in disrepair. And the state has this great thing called the employee retirement system that needs about $1 billion a year, and it's really hard for both the state and the county to fight over these breadcrumbs, you know, $100 million here, $100 million there, when their revenue requirements are in the billions.
Right, and then I know, getting back to that constitutional amendment, the issue there is the devil will be in the details when the lawmakers come back, if it passes this fall, to craft the language, and because there are lots of questions about, will it go to pay for teachers' raises or something else?
And once they start funding education, does that mean they have abdicated their role in terms of budgeting for public education? Do they go, okay, well, you have this funding source now, and, you know, we can just put up our hands and sit on our hands and not do anything?
Right. And as far as that one went, it passed in both houses by 2/3, and so it does not need the governor's signature.
Well, it doesn't need it because of it's a constitutional amendment. And it's, you know, it's veto-proof anyway, I mean, with that kind of a majority.
And so record time in putting the budget to bed.
Putting the budget to bed. They were forced into that position because they had to pass the executive operating budget and the capital improvement budget. before they can do any appropriations bills, the biggest one being the $125 million for the disaster relief following the April 13th floods on Kauai and Oahu. So they had to pass the budget. They did it in 2 days, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, unbelievable.
without any bickering at all. And so that's something that was really well done really quickly.
Are there any other biggies?
The Senate's Mauna Kea management issue, I think that failed. They didn't have much support on the House side anyway. Senator Kaialii Kahele and Senator Donovan Dela Cruz tried to, they even got and replaced the House bill and tried to put a moratorium on Mauna Kea building telescopes. And they also tried to make it a management shift from the University of Hawaii to a board, but that failed. The House didn't even consider the bill.
Any other hot-button issues that look like they're gaining traction or that the conferees might be close on?
The one I think is the most important bill right now floating through the legislature is Senate Bill 3095, which is the pesticide buffer zones around schools. I think that one really, they're really far apart in terms of trying to find common ground. The Senate is of the point that they don't want pesticide reporting by the big companies, I guess because on Maui, on Kauai, you've got the big GMO companies. And there's some resistance there, but, you know, that's the most important part of the bill, to know where they're spraying pesticides and, you know, in what amounts and, you know, exactly where and when.
Any surprises for you? Because you've been covering the ledge for a while.
I think the Death with Dignity bill was the most surprising because, you know, we covered it for so many years in terms of its religious-based opponents. Then it went to a medical-based, you know, people weren't happy with what was happening there. But I think when it moved to the civil rights issue and something that they said it's our care and our choice, I think that took it to a different level. And I think everyone in the legislature anyway felt that, you know, this is something that we can all wrap our heads around and say we need to have people at least have that choice. Oh, the big one, paid family leave. I think that's still hanging in the air. They're going to go back to conference. I think they are pretty close in terms of finalizing the bill. I think the House is really way behind it. I mean, they passed it unanimously. So I think that's going to be something that they need to pass relatively quickly before the midnight deadline anyway.
Would you be surprised if the Airport Authority died, that bill, to create that special board?
It's died before. I think people are afraid, or the lawmakers are afraid, to give that much authority to the airport. When Ford Fujikami was the director of transportation, he pushed that hard, and it passed one House, but it didn't pass the other. And so the lawmakers are saying, wait a minute now, we need to have some oversight, because that special fund is not taxpayer money. It's all the airport tenants that are paying that money. And really, if you give that authority away, the legislature has no say on how the Department of Transportation Airports Division spends that money.
What about the funding for Hawaii Tourism Authority?
I think that measure is really opposed by the House. They don't like the fact that the Hawaii Tourism Authority would lose that kind of money. And besides, you know, it's the hotel companies that are paying to have the Hawaii Tourism Authority spend all that promotion money. And we are going to go into a time when tourism is going to dip. And, you know, it's coming. I mean, it's a cycle. You know, it's a cycle. So I think everyone's afraid that, hey, you take away that money and, you know, you time it with the slump in tourism, and you will probably be blamed as being the cause.
Yeah, okay. Well, a couple more days, but we've seen things get resurrected on the last day, too. So
beware, gut, and replace.
Okay, all right. Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you.
That was Wayne Yoshioka, HPR's political reporter. The 2018 legislative session ends on May 3rd, which is Thursday. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaii Island residents weigh in on a bill to regulate vacation rentals. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of a president who went to Punahou, and no, it's not Barack Obama. This physician, writer, philosopher, and political revolutionary was the founding father and first president of the Republic of China. Before he was influencing change in traditional China, he was a student here at Iolani School. He started as a 13-year-old boarding student in 1879 who did not speak any English, but by the time he graduated in 1882, he won an award for grammar presented to him by King David Kalākaua. Immediately after graduating from Iolani, he went to Punahou for one semester when it was still called Oahu College. Those early years in Hawaii carried through to his later political philosophy known as the Three Principles of the People, highlighting nationalism, democracy, and the livelihood of the people. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this world leader? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
A hearing on a bill to regulate vacation rentals on the Big Island drew more than 100 people this week. We talked with the co-authors of the measure, council members Karen Eoff and Drew Kanuha. There's still a long way to go before a law is passed, and it may not be until the fall that something could be in place.
We heard their concerns. We heard all sides of the issue. We heard from realtors. We heard from operators of short-term vacation rentals. We heard from non-residents, speculators, and we heard a lot from our residents who really wish to preserve the residential nature of their neighborhoods and also ensure opportunities for our local families to find affordable housing. So we heard quite a bit, and it was kind of it was interesting because right now the form that the bill is in has some parts that people completely support and some things that they'd like to see changed. So I'm thinking that the legislative process has a ways to go. We put together, Mr. Councilman Kanuha and I put together what we thought was at least something ready to be discussed among the rest of the council members. And we expect that after we all learn and understand more about all the different aspects of regulation, that we'll come up with a good bill that we then would have to send to our planning commission. We have a leeward and a windward planning commission. So our process is that anytime we amend the zoning code, the council, if it starts with the council, which this one does, it has to be sent to the planning commission for their review and recommendations. So after that happens, it comes back to our council's planning committee for more discussion, public input, testimony, and everything. And then it still would have to face like at least a couple more readings before a law can actually be passed. We're actually the only county in the state that has no regulation. We don't even have a definition of a short-term vacation rental in our code, which is why we have to do this. And this bill takes, like I said, a moderate approach. We're not sure how it's going to end up, but right now we're trying to determine just how we can deal with all the ones that are currently existing.
I know,
maybe in residential neighborhoods.
I know I talked to one Big Island guy, and he was on the Hilo side, and he said that he brought his kids back to see where their home was, and his family lost his home, but he said every home on that street, he said, they were all vacation rentals. He was just really shocked at
how much we heard. A lot of stories yesterday such as that, and we know for a fact that there's investors, off-island, non-resident, who are just investing in multiple homes and turning them to vacation rentals. And that's why there's a bit of an urgency for us to get a handle on this.
Anything that you heard yesterday that struck you in, you know, any particular way that maybe affected your way of thinking or kind of either underscored your position or maybe changed your mind?
No, even before hearing the public testimony, we've heard from a lot of constituents and a lot of people once they knew that county was looking at proposing legislation. We heard from the various stakeholders on all sides of the issue for the last several months. So I pretty much knew the conflicting problems, mm-hmm. and to try and find a solution that is well-balanced and yet it may not please everybody. There may not be a way to legislate something that works for everybody, you know, and zoning is especially a difficult task because there's characters of the areas of our island that differ very much. Some rural, some are more geared up for vacationers, and others are more solely, you know, rural in nature or agricultural. So, yeah. Poses some problems for us, but that's what we're looking at.
Right. So the committee didn't take any action. You just listened to the testimony.
Right. Okay. And we had some discussion.
Right.
We had members of the planning department and the administration and our attorneys there to answer questions and start to help all the other council members who haven't, been able to talk about this as yet until it becomes, you know, introduced and discussed in public. Mm-hmm. We can't talk among ourselves.
Right.
It was sunshine law. So it was a good opportunity to hear where the different council members are starting to, you know, develop their opinions.
We did get someone who emailed us concerned about the problems with just long-term rentals and the landlord-tenant code. I don't know if you mm-hmm. heard any of that yesterday.
Well, we have heard that some people choose the short-term rental option because there's problems with long-term renters, and yes, you know, but I think that's all state law that would have to be changed to improve that situation.
Right. And then, now, would your bill allow for, operators, like bed and breakfast? Because I know they were talking about that here in Honolulu.
We already have a regulation for bed and breakfast in our code.
And what would that?
A bed and breakfast is considered a situation where the owner lives on their own property and they can get a permit from the planning commission and it becomes a permitted use. So we have vacation rentals already regulated in our code and there are certain provisions that they have to abide by.
Okay, so that's allowed, but it's just the mm-hmm. whole homes or homes that are operating.
It's allowed, yeah.
Outside of the resort area.
Right, bed and breakfasts are allowed in residential areas. Bed and breakfast can be a permitted use in a residential area.
Okay. Are there any numbers that you have on estimates for Big Island?
You know, somebody threw out a number yesterday that there were like 8,000 vacation rentals on the island, but I think that might be a combination of things.
How's your enforcement end? Because I know Honolulu's is not very good.
Right. Well, we're going to have to create the bill actually creates an enforcement account, and we would really have to beef up the personnel and staff to be able to handle not only the program, because there's a registration and other things that will be, you know, a demand on the department. So, yes, we really have to look at the enforcement side.
Karen and I really tried to strike a balance between all the different perspectives, and I really think we came out with a decent proposal, and now it's just ready to go through the vetting process of showing the public what's happening and hearing from the council members of how we want to move forward.
Do you have any thoughts about the state bill that lawmakers here on Oahu are trying to craft?
I think, you know, I can't keep up with the state bill as it keeps changing every single time we hear it. So I don't know the current version of it, but if they are trying to propose or give the counties greater authority over how we regulate vacation rentals, I'm all for it.
Right, and then also just to work something so that the state can collect the taxes through the operator, through Airbnb.
Yeah, I think with our greater enforcement of the short-term vacation rentals on Hawaii Island, especially we're going to be looking at those that are illegal, you know, not paying the GET, TAT, which is in our bill. It'll give the state greater TAT monies, which, you know, in turn, we always hope that we can get a greater return on our TAT investment on Hawaii Island as well. You know, I think Hawaii Island is a unique island. It's completely different from the rest of the islands. Everybody has their own way of doing things, and within our, you know, our island is so big, and as Karen pointed out, we have very unique towns and places that a lot of us live. You have the rural areas of Kohala and Kau, and we have the resort areas of Kona and downtown Hilo, and then you go into places that don't have hotels that can accommodate a lot of visitors, such as Volcano and Puna. It's extremely unique, and so we're trying to craft it under that unique premise that Hawaii Island is a special place, and there are opportunities to make a good bill in how for the entire island.
And then still also preserve some of the character of those towns and areas.
Absolutely. We're trying to make sure that we don't lose the uniqueness of our places. That's what a lot of people come here for. I've grown up on this island. I was born and raised here. My family's been here for countless generations. So it's very, very special to me. So I don't want to lose that history. I don't want to lose that culture. I don't want to lose those places that make us who we are. And I think this bill is taking a step forward in making sure that we can preserve a lot of what we hold dear.
You're hearing from Hawaii County Council members Drew Kanuha and Karen Ioffe, co-authors of a bill to regulate vacation rentals. We talk with them following a late-night public hearing this week. The meeting is to resume on May 8th. Council members are expected to introduce amendments to the bill then.
An important court decision is coming up on the Lewis and Catherine Kealoha case. The former police chief and his city prosecutor wife face a variety of conspiracy charges, along with several co-defendants, and federal prosecutors want them tried all together. Their alleged co-conspirators are pushing for separate trials, and a judge will decide next week whether they get their wish. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has more in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
What's at stake here? You know, what's the difference?
Well, really, the court, Judge Seabright, the federal judge, is really trying to balance two issues. One is the desire for judicial efficiency and economy, which would call for one big trial with everything taken care of at once. On the other side is a sort of right to a fair trial that we have under the Constitution, mm-hmm. and the idea that information could prejudice the jury against defendants that really have nothing to do with some of the charges.
Is it risky to try everyone all together? I mean, one hears that conspiracy is especially hard to prove.
Well, I think that's partly what's going on here. In a way, there are two big buckets of allegations, if you think about it. On one hand, there's this conspiracy allegation involving a mailbox,
right.
A stolen mailbox, and evidence that was created by police officers, this whole scheme. On the other hand, there are financial crimes involving bank fraud and a misappropriation of trust monies from some kids, and those are pretty easy to prove. Mm-hmm. So they're just paper cases. So the prosecutors want to put them all together, and the defendants are saying, no, they're totally separate. They should be completely different. So that's really the issue, and the risk is that the police officers who are alleged to be part of the conspiracy would be somehow unfairly sort of tarnished by association with a somewhat easier to prove series of allegations involving and counts involving bank fraud and misappropriation of trust money from some kids.
And in the case of what you refer to as paper cases, they have incriminating documents, right?
Well, they seem to. Again, it seems relatively easy to prove those. So, yes, it does seem like they have that, plus testimony from one of the kids who said he lied to cover it up.
Which would make getting everyone convicted all at once, presumably the prosecutor's goal, that would make it that much easier for them, one would think, huh?
Well, it'd be easier to nail the Kelohas on the misappropriation of trust funds and that sort of series of cases, as well as obstruction of justice and those related cases. So, yes, that makes it easier to get someone on those. The question is, do the police officers, who arguably might have had nothing to do with that, get sort of sucked into that and blamed somehow for that?
Well, this is a trial we're going to be watching with a lot of interest. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thank you, Chris.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. And to read his full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read. Some things that you might like to see, but they're all addressed to me.
Last week's segment about the state's pilot programming allowing Uber and Lyft to pick up passengers from the Honolulu airport spurred Michelle from Kaneohe to call our talkback line and share her family's experience.
This is in response to your conversation the other day about Uber and Lyft. My name is Michelle Grotstein. I'm calling you from Kaneohe. My son was a limo driver for over 10 years in Austin, Texas. He lost that because of Uber and Lyft. As soon as Uber and Lyft came to town, the local taxi companies, the local limo companies, like the one my son worked for, were eliminated. It didn't happen right away, but within a year, these small businesses were gone because Uber and Lyft did not have to abide by the same rules. Please don't let that happen in Honolulu. Thank you. Bye.
We heard from a lot of listeners following Tuesday's show on funding education with property taxes. John McGurry wrote in and saying, I've been listening on and off to the broadcast concerning funding schools. I'm in the classroom and observe many things going on. I agree with many of things, outsiders driving up local costs, schools needing more funds for teachers and supplies. Yet I would like to add to the discussion that there's also the need for evaluating efficiency of the Department of Education. We should not add money to the budget without also increasing the efficiency and decrease waste of where the money is already going. Many policies are archaic, leading to a dysfunctional system. Alan from Kihei and Chris from Kaneohe both called into our talkback line to talk about the idea of using the investment property surcharge to help schools.
Good morning. It's Alan Pelzer in Kihei. And other states that I'm familiar with, there's property taxes for education, not just on residences, but on agricultural land and also commercial property. Why are we doing this all on residences? Like, can't ag and commercial property pick it up? It's sort of embarrassing to be on Hawaii and know something about education here. Mahalo.
Hi, this is Chris from Kaneohe. My wife is a teacher, and she was recently teaching at Makapu Elementary on Marine Corps Base Hawaii. And the amount of funding that she would speak on and the amount of support that teachers required, it just didn't match up to the point where, just like one of your panelists said, the teachers are purchasing funds out of their own pocket to provide the education required to the student. The state isn't providing it, so they're coming out of their own pocket. We're taking money away from our own children so they can receive an adequate education. And it is just so frustrating to see that people can't get on board with the same mindset and have the same goal.
And Robert Vafai from Maui wrote this. I heard the discussion and believe firmly in using property tax to go to schools. Keep it up. My wife sub-teaches in DOE. My daughter is at Kalama Mid School. I can tell you, our schools need more money. Very important is get some honest and creative and smart upper management in DOE, because just giving them more money without using those funds wisely is what is already happening. The admin in DOE should be held accountable, and they are not currently.
Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter. Call our talkback line at 792-8217.
Research scientists are learning more and more about rapid ohia death, which has devastated Hawaii Island forests since its outbreak within the past decade. It kills quickly, begins with few outward signs, and can be spread easily by hikers walking through Hawaii's native forests. Dr. Lisa Keith, research plant pathologist at the USDA Agricultural Research Service Laboratory in Hilo, has been working with colleagues as far away as South Africa and Iowa to study the species of fungi that cause the disease. She says there are some signs of hope that this killer of native forests can be contained.
Although we have new outbreak areas, it seems like the areas that have been showing a large percentage of mortality have come kind of tapered out. So a much better picture than when we first discovered the problem back in 2014.
What has made the picture a better picture?
I think a lot of it is actually figuring out what we were dealing with, so what fungi were involved, how the biology affects how these fungi spread around. And so really, with researchers working hand-in-hand with management and having an excellent outreach team, getting the information that we all learn and sharing with the public on how to limit spread, I think that really helped a lot.
The public, with all the best of intentions, has sort of inadvertently abetted the spread, hasn't it? In the past.
Even the public have learned a lot on how to limit spread, not moving firewood around, really being proactive in cleaning their boots and not taking potentially infected material into new areas, that it really is helping limit the spread.
The encouraging thing here, Lisa, is that public education campaigns work, at least judging from what you're telling me about this.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we have a great outreach team. They're innovative in how they get information spread. You know, the real critical thing is really just the importance of ohia and what role they play in our environment, really understanding how critical they are to life, and then understanding, well, this disease has potential to wreak a lot of havoc, that there are lots of things that people can do to help limit the spread.
Such as? I mean, you described cleaning your boots after a hike. What other kinds of things?
Yeah, so really not moving firewood around from infected areas to another. We definitely know that wounding trees, the fungus needs a wound to get in.
Mm.
So if you can avoid landscaping, you know, weed whacking around your area, the trunks, minimize your pruning efforts. Even there are examples of some animals on property that decide to kind of damage the bark.
Hmm.
We can see new infections starting this way. So if you can prevent those from happening, and with no wounding event, then the fungi won't get in and actually cause disease.
Let's say a tree has a scar on it. You know, you make a, you as you put a wound a tree. How do the fungi get there? Through the air? Through spores? How does it travel?
Yes. So the fungi themselves don't travel in the air. They're actually attached to wood material or boring dust of beetles. So we know that beetles like to bore into dead and dying trees anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what some of the newer studies are finding is that the material that they liberate and actually kick out into the environment of infected trees can contain the spores of fungi.
Hmm.
And so, you know, that material can get around. So that's why it is critical that if you are in a diseased area and this material gets into the soil, I mean, you can easily track that.
How can you tell if a tree is infected?
Well, that's the tricky part with this disease.
Yeah.
Rapidohia death, we don't see anything with the leaves, with the blossoms. We don't notice anything on the outside of the trunk.
Hmm.
So really, the telltale sign, if you see a healthy canopy die very rapidly, meaning the leaves wilt, they turn brown, they remain attached to that canopy, and if it seems like it happens, say, less than a month, you can look inside of the tree. You can actually see vascular discoloration. So internal discoloration inside the sapwood. And most often then that is due to rapidohia death or these fungi called ceratocystis. And it would be helpful, especially if you're in a new area where there doesn't seem to be a lot of disease occurring, you can get your wood sampled. So that really is the best way. You know, unfortunately, we can't see anything on the outside, but we can test the wood and actually determine if ceratocystis killed the trees.
Let's say you had a tree on your property or near you that you suspected of being infected. What should you cut it down? What should you do about it?
Yeah, actually, you know, there is kind of a decision tree that's available. And there is a website, rapidohiadeath.org. Mm-hmm. A bunch of information's on there for frequently asked questions and some of exactly what to do if you suspect you have a tree. So if it is dead, then you can either get it tested or you really look for if there's a lot of beetle activity occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really don't see any of that powdery substance coming out of your tree due to beetles boring in,
mm-hmm.
And it's not a hazard tree, it's better to just leave the tree standing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If it does need to be brought down, I mean, we recommend that a certified arborist is called, and there is a list available on the website. And then if you're interested in sampling, you can get a small sample of the inside of the sapwood, particularly if there is discoloration, how to do it, and even the forms and where to send it is available on the website, and it'll step you through exactly what you need to do.
There is no current remedy, right? We just have to contain this. We don't know how to get rid of it. Rapidohia death.
Well, unfortunately, there is no cure once a tree becomes infected.
Mm-hmm.
So we researchers are working on methods to try to protect trees better from getting infected in the first place. We're also trying to, because there's a lot of infected wood, how to best treat that wood to make it safe for movement. And I guess another critical thing is really doing a lot of testing to see if host resistance is in the population. So there are many varieties, and some of the greenhouse studies that we're looking at definitely showing promise that not every tree responds to infection the same way.
In that finding, I would think there would be some kind of hope, yeah?
Yes, yes. So like I mentioned, you know, when we first discovered the disease, boy, it really seemed like the forest would be really decimated all over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case. I mean, there's The disease can be found, the fungi can be found in all districts of Hawaii Island. Right now it's only on Hawaii Island, and you know, with the quarantine in place, HDOA was very proactive to help limit the spread. But various areas, you know, maybe you see a tree or two have become infected, and oftentimes you can look and see that a man-made wound, unfortunately, started the infection process. So it definitely, there's great hope that many, many thousands of acres of healthy forest will remain.
Dr. Lisa Keith is a research plant pathologist at the USDA Agricultural Research Service Laboratory in Hilo. You can learn more about her study on our Conversation Facebook page.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a Chinese political leader with roots in Hawaii as an Iolani and Punahou school graduate. But at one point, questions arose about the birthplace of the founding father of the Republic of China. A birth certificate issued by the Territory of Hawaii in March 1904 claimed he was born in Kulamaui. Today, it's widely known that this revolutionary was born in China's Guangdong province. But at the time, the Maui birth certificate allowed him to travel freely in and out of the U.S. and avoid the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. He visited the island six times and said, "It was here that I came to understand what modern civilized governments are like and what they mean." The spark of inspiration pushed him to launch a revolt against the Qing dynasty in hopes of moving away from what he saw as backwards traditions. Today, you can see memorials to the first president of the Republic of China, Sun Yat-sen, in parks in Honolulu and Maui, as well as across China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong.
And that's today's quiz. The winner is Ariel Stenick of Chinatown, first to call with the right answer. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Career Center, where students can explore possible careers, get localized data, and understand expectations for those careers. Achieve3000.com.
Nobel Prize-winning novelist John Steinbeck probably understood the heart and soul of America during the Great Depression as well as anyone, and found a kind of nobility in the downtrodden masses that drifted around the country during those troubled years. His novella Of Mice and Men has survived for generations by reminding us that even the losers among us have their dreams to pursue. Alexis Desculius is directing the Maui onstage production of the American classic, and she's with us by phone. Good morning, Alexis.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Sure. What do you think that makes these two guys the archetypes that they have become?
Well, interesting. I was just having this conversation with some of the actors, which is, I think what draws us in so much is that they are us, especially George. George is kind of the everyman, and I think that's also why 80 years later, the character still rings true for so many people. His struggles and what he's trying to overcome are the same struggles that we all still continue to face, you know, finding that American dream and making sure that we are true to ourselves.
He's also got a sidekick that he kind of has to look out for, doesn't he?
He does, and don't we all have those in our lives? Hopefully maybe not quite as flawed, but yeah, Lenny, the character of Lenny is, you know, he is a mentally challenged, very large person, and he is completely has a heart of gold, and that heart of gold, unfortunately, sometimes gets him into trouble because of his size.
You know, it used to be a tradition in literature and drama that the characters had to be sort of, maybe of noble birth, or, you know, the thing
right.
That's happened in modern drama is that, you know, we have losers like George and Lenny Death of a Salesman, you know.
Absolutely.
Attention must be paid, right?
Yes, exactly. Willie Loman. Yeah, very, very similar in a way. Although I would say that the end of this story certainly gives us a little more hope Mm-hmm. I feel it gives us hope.
Yeah.
In the sense that our friends and our true friendships are always going to, you know, win. Our love for someone and the bonds that we have between men are always going to win out.
Do you think that was part of Steinbeck's gift, his understanding?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely. I mean, look at The Grapes of Wrath or Tortilla Flat or The Cannery Row, any of those books. I mean, I realize that so many people look at them as tragedies, but really what they are is they're about the American dream and they're about the core of the American soul. And we all have flaws. You know, it's all about writing about real people and real people's struggles. And I think that's also why, again, that these stories are still taught. They still ring true because even though the circumstances may change, the struggles are still there. They're still, at our core base, the same struggles.
Well, it's an awful lot easier to identify with an ordinary person than it is with Henry V, right?
It is. And, you know, it's interesting you say that. It's easier as an audience member. It's not easier as an actor, which is why I think the character of George and the character of Candy and Slim, the kind of the everyday people, they're more challenging for actors to portray.
That's a good point. It's easy to be, you know, larger than life, especially
exactly.
For an actor. It's tough to make an ordinary person interesting. Yeah, you know? Is that
that's
the challenge?
Exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is, and I think that's why people shy away from, you know, doing productions like this. It, kind of like you're saying, it's easier to do Henry V or a Shakespeare piece, or even really Death of a Salesman, because Willie Loman does have a tragic flaw for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how do you communicate that to the actors? You know, be ordinary, but still be compelling.
through a longer rehearsal process
uh-huh.
And through really talking about the text. And we're really fortunate on Maui. We have some incredibly talented performers, actors and actresses here on Maui. But also the script, you know, it's the only John Steinbeck book story. I mean, it's a novella because it's so short, but
yeah.
It's the only Steinbeck piece that was actually transcribed into a play by Steinbeck himself.
Yeah, I
so
know.
All the words are his words. And it's interesting, you know, you have to assume that there are reasons why, you know, there's very minimal, but there are a few changes here or there, and you have to just assume that he took them out for a very specific reason.
Well, the skills of a dramatist and the skills of a novelist are different, right?
Very different. Very different, but it's interesting that he wrote this book, you know, if you remember reading it, and most people read it in intermediate school or high school.
Sure.
And when you read it, you don't get into the brains of any of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's written from a very interesting point of view where you don't know what everybody's thinking. You only know their actions.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very... That's very much a modern, very much a 20th century literature.
Right, exactly. And so you have to make assumptions about the characters based on their actions. And Steinbeck's very descriptive about their actions and how they walk into the room and how they look. His descriptions about how they look and how they interact with their surroundings and with nature are what have created these vibrant characters for us. It's not that we actually know what the characters are thinking. We all interpret what they're thinking based on the description that Steinbeck gave us.
You know, Alexis, I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but you just reminded me of Camus' character in The Stranger.
Oh, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Why is he doing... We are given no hint as to why
exactly.
He does strange...
Exactly. That's exactly it. I honestly think that is another reason why this story just rings true, because we each can interpret and can identify with different characters. And, you know, in this story, I don't feel there's really any antagonist. They're all protagonists. Even Curly, who maybe seems a little bit like the antagonist, he's not. I mean, they're all just trying to pursue their own dream.
Which is the way people are, you know, human life doesn't break down into three acts and antagonist, protagonist.
Exactly.
Alexis, it sounds like a pretty interesting production. It sounds as if it's been fun for you to put together.
Oh,
as well.
It's been very, very rewarding. It is a beautiful piece of American literature. It's a beautiful theatrical piece. The set and the lighting and all the technical elements have really pulled together, And I just keep reminding people, you may not leave the theater singing, you know, some Broadway hit song, but you will leave the theater wanting to go and have a conversation with whomever you sat next to. You will want to discuss this piece.
You make me want to reread the book. Thanks a lot.
I highly suggest it.
Alexis Deskoulis is the director of the Maui Onstage production of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, which runs weekends from tonight to May 13th at the Iao Theater in Wailuku.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, an update on Kauai's recovery from disastrous flooding.
And our congratulations go out to Hawaii State champion Nicholas Amador, who we interviewed here on The Conversation. He placed second in the National Poetry Out Loud competition in Washington, D.C. He was awarded $10,000 from the National Endowment of the Arts, and Nicholas made history. He's the only student to ever place in the top three more than once at the national finals, placing third in 2016 and second in 2017. We would like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. And you can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, you can find it on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
The Backyard Quiz theme written by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday for more of The Conversation.